Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 23, 2018, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic will be a Courthouse Steps discussion on the District of Columbia v. Wesby decision. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Brian Weir, who is an associate at Consovoy McCarthy Park PLLC. After Brian's remarks, we will open for an audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us today, Brian. The floor is now yours.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on to discuss this interesting case. Before I start getting into what the case is about, I think it's helpful to just note that it's an unusual case for a couple of reasons. First, it doesn't really fit within the normal menu of cases at the Supreme Court. It really is a fact-bound application of established legal principles. The case doesn't really break any new ground there, so it's less of a legal focus, and given that it's a criminal procedure question about probable cause, it really is a very fact-bound question, which I'll try to get through as quickly as possible. Second, the facts themselves sound a lot like they came from a criminal procedure final of that weird professor you had from law school. Just to give you a preview, Professor Josh Blackman said this is the first time that the phrase, quote, lap dance has appeared in a Supreme Court opinion. So that gives you a little bit of what we're dealing with here. To start, this case is about 16 individuals who were arrested for attending what the court described as a raucous late-night party in a house where they did not have permission to enter. To focus the facts some, the individuals themselves were arrested for unlawful entry under D.C. law. In this case, it's undisputed that these partygoers were not given permission to enter the home by the actual homeowner, who himself was not present. But D.C.'s unlawful entry law has a mens rea requirement. So to be guilty of unlawful entry, you must not only be in a home unlawfully without permission, you must, quote, have known or should have known that you didn't have permission to enter the home. So this case revolves around whether there was probable cause that these 16 partygoers knew or should have known that they did not have permission to be on this particular property at this particular party. So here are the facts that go to that issue. At about 1 a.m. in March 2008, about a decade ago, D.C. police received a call about a loud music and illegal activities at a house in northeast D.C. The caller told police that the house at issue had been vacant for months, and when officers arrived, several neighbors confirmed that the house should have been empty because it had been empty for months prior. The officers approached the house and heard loud noises coming out consistent with the call they received. And when officers knocked at the door to enter, they saw one man look out the window, who then turned around and ran upstairs, fleeing the police officers. Officers then entered the home, and they observed that the inside of the house was basically in disarray, and it looked like it was, in fact, a vacant property. They also smelled marijuana, saw beer bottles scattered all over the place, and cups of liquor all over the floor. The ground itself was so dirty that one partygoer refused to even sit down while being questioned. This is where it gets interesting. In the living room, the officers found a, quote, makeshift strip club with, quote, several women wearing only bras and thongs with cash tucked into their garter belts. These women were giving partygoers lap dances while others watched, and the partygoers themselves had money in their hands that they were giving to the entertainers. When those partygoers saw the officers, many scattered to other parts of the house, presumably in fear of the police officers being there. Upstairs, the officers found what the court's opinion described as more debauchery. They found a naked woman and several men in a bedroom with a bare mattress on the floor and several used condoms scattered around the room. And they also found a partygoer hiding in a closet. The house itself only had a few indications that it could be inhabited, one of which was blinds that were still on the windows. There was some food in the refrigerator. There were some toiletries in the bathroom. And there was the aforementioned mattress on the floor in the one bedroom. That's all there was in the house that suggested the house actually had occupants. So as they normally do, officers then questioned everybody at the party and could not really get a clear story as to what was going on. Some partygoers said it was a bachelor party, but no one could identify exactly who the bachelor was. Every partygoer said they were invited to the house, but no one could say by whom. they were invited. The two women who were working as entertainers at the party said that a woman named Peaches, or Tasty, was renting the house and had given them permission to be there. But they didn't know Peaches' real name, and Peaches herself was not even there. One of the women did have Peaches' cell phone number, so they called her and the police spoke with her. Peaches said that she was renting the house and had given the attendees permission to be there. But when she was pressed on who gave her permission to use the house, she became pretty evasive and hung up. The officers got her on the phone again, and then on that second call, she admitted that she did not have permission to be using the home. It turned out that she had been negotiating a lease with the homeowner, but they had not reached a decision quite yet, so she did not have permission to use the home. The officers then contacted the owner, who said, yes, nobody had permission to be there. Peaches did not have permission to be there, although they were trying to work out a lease for her to be there. So the officers arrested everyone there for unlawful entry. There's actually 21 or 22 people there. They arrested each and one of them and took them down to the station. Eventually, the police dropped all charges, and I guess in their mind thought the event was over, but 16 of the partygoers decided otherwise. They sued the officers under Section 1983, claiming that the officers did not have probable cause that the partygoers were unlawfully entered the home. And they focused on the fact that, at least to their in their mind, that there was no probable cause that the partygoers, quote, knew or should have known that they did not have permission to enter the home. Some of them had been told by people who were at the party that it was a party for anybody, so many of the partygoers sort of had thought they had permission to enter the home and were kind of caught in the crossfire of the police coming in, for lack of a better word. For the district court, the parties filed cross motions for summary judgment after discovery, and the two arguments were, one, whether there was probable cause to arrest the individuals, and if so, for qualified immunity purposes, whether it was clearly established that there was no probable cause. The district court actually granted summary judgment for the partygoers on liability. District court held both that there was not probable cause to arrest the individuals, focusing primarily on the fact that many had been told it was a party open to anyone, or something along those lines. And the district court held that it was clearly established that there was no probable cause in this case because there was no evidence that the partygoers knew or should have known that they were there unlawfully. Damages went to a jury. DC jury awarded the partygoer $680,000 in damages, and the attorneys about $1 million in fees. So pretty good makeout for the plaintiffs there. On appeal, the DC Circuit affirmed in a 2-1 decision. The majority, which was Judge Pillard and Judge Edwards, agreed that there was no probable cause in the case, and that it was that was actually clearly established by existing case law that there was no probable cause to arrest the partygoers. The majority said it was, quote, perfectly clear, in fact, that there was no probable cause, because the panel focused primarily on the fact that many of the partygoers had what the panel described as a bona fide belief of their right to enter. That is, they had been told by somebody, not the homeowner, but somebody, that it was a party, and they were just attending a party. They had no idea that whoever was hosting the party, whoever started the party, actually did not have permission to be there. Judge Janice Rogers Brown dissented, saying that under basically standard qualified immunity, it was not a clearly established question. So the Supreme Court granted cert in January of 2016, and the case was argued, I believe, in October, October 4th, and issued the decision yesterday. In the decision, the Supreme Court reversed unanimously. Seven justices, all but Justice Ginsburg and Justice Sotomayor, held that there was probable cause in this case, that the partygoers knew or should have known that they did not have permission to be there. And all nine justices agreed that in any event, it was not clearly established that the officers did not have probable cause here. Justice Thomas wrote the decision for the court. And basically, it was a straightforward application of probable cause case law in the first instance and qualified immunity law in the second on the second question. So he wrote that the totality of the circumstances showed that the officers made the entirely reasonable inference, as he described it, that the partygoers were knowingly taking advantage of a vacant house. I mean, he focused on all the salacious facts of the case. He pointed to the condition of the house, which suggested that the partygoers were not invited because invited guests typically don't trash a house in the way that the house had appeared to be trashed. He pointed to the partygoers' conduct specifically, especially the fact that many partygoers fled or scurried away when the police entered a room. I think the best quote is from the opinion. There's two, really. The first is, quote, "Most homeowners do not invite people over to use their living room as a strip club, to have sex in their bedroom, to smoke marijuana inside, and to leave the floors filthy." To him, to the court, that was enough to print the inference that the partygoers knew they didn't have permission to be there, just the general state of the house. And I think my favorite line was, "People normally do not throw a bachelor party without a bachelor." That was enough to undermine the partygoers' credibility that they had permission to be there and to permit the officers the inference that they knew they should not have been there. So the court basically admonished the D.C. Circuit for taking a hyper-technical view of each fact in isolation to explain away the partygoers' mental state. Going back decades, the Supreme Court has said officers are entitled to review the totality of the circumstances and should not take each individual fact in isolation, officers are not required to adopt or explain away an innocent explanation for conduct that otherwise appears unlawful. They're allowed to use their experience to draw inferences as to what's actually going on. Court also admonished the D.C. Circuit for basically requiring 100% certain proof that a crime had been committed when probable cause is a much lower standard. For qualified immunity, again, the court applied well-known standard about whether something is clearly established, whether a right is clearly established, and not defining sort of the right itself at too high of a level. And the court found that here there was just given the facts, it was reasonable for an officer to believe he or she had probable cause to arrest the partygoers for unlawful entry. Justice Sotomayor concurred. She said there's no reason really to get into whether or not there was probable cause in this particular case. It was enough to just dismiss the case on qualified immunity. She would not have gotten into the merits of the case, and she acknowledged that it was a quote, heavily fact-bound decision, so she didn't feel the need to get into the weeds on the details. And Justice Ginsburg concurred. She also said could have been disposed on qualified immunity, but she said probably the most interesting thing in the case in her concurrence, in that she was concerned about police accountability and suggested that the court revisit its longstanding rule that an arresting officer's state of mind is irrelevant to the probable cause standard. In this case, the main officer who decided to arrest the partygoers didn't actually realize there was a mens rea requirement for unlawful entry. He thought that if he found somebody in a house and they didn't have permission, that was enough to violate the unlawful to be guilty of unlawful entry, when in fact you have to know or should have known that you were there unlawfully. So what's the ultimate takeaway of this case? There's really no new ground here. The court didn't announce any new legal principles. In fact, I think by the time argument came around and for the case, it was granted in January 2016 and argued in October 2016. When people got their head into the case, I think a lot of people questioned really why the court took it in the first place. The court's standard for taking cases, for granting cert petitions under Rule 10 is there a circuit split or is it an important question? The court doesn't really get into error correction of lower courts misapplying clearly established law, not clearly established law, but applying sort of the law incorrectly. This case raised no new Fourth Amendment issues, nothing novel. And in fact, the petitioner, the District of Columbia, didn't even ask the court really to alter its qualified immunity analysis anyway. The case really was about a misapplication of pre-existing law. So, in a lot of instances, in cases like this, where the lower court got it so wrong, what the Supreme Court typically does is it will summarily reverse the Court of Appeals in a per curiam opinion without argument, without briefing. And that's what this case really looks like. It's summary reversal, sort of with briefing and with argument. My own theory as to why the court took it, again, it was granted. It was in the last conference in January of 2016. During the last conference in January is the last time the court can get put a case on its current term schedule to get it on the April 26th calendar, April calendar for that year. At that time in January 2016, we still had an 8 justice Supreme Court. This was not a type of case that's going to split 5-4, so there was no concern that it would be a 4-4 case that the court would have to affirm. So I think they were just trying to fill out their docket for April 2016 when they were just 8 justices. And then the District of Columbia filed a motion sort of to extend the case or to move the case to the next term. And so though it was originally going to be heard in April 2016, it was ultimately heard in October when they had 9 justices. So that's my summary of the case, so I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Brian. Let's go ahead and move to audience questions. While we wait for some questions to build in the audience, I just wanted to ask you, Brian, why do you believe Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg didn't join the majority opinion?
I think as this case got close, the only question people had was would they decide both questions or would they not? The determination that there was probable cause in this case actually disposed of some state law claims that the partygoers brought, and Justice Sotomayor thought that was a better for the lower courts to decide than the Supreme Court to sort of dispose of them in passing as it made its determination as a probable cause. So I think that's why she didn't join the merits proposition. For Justice Ginsburg, she did express some concern about the police officer's conduct in the case, which I kept out primarily because it wasn't central to the court's analysis. The officers, again, one officer made a mistake of law when he arrested the partygoers, thinking that there was no mens rea requirement. And recently, the court has held that if a police officer makes a reasonable mistake of law in arresting somebody, that's actually not going to violate, or it may violate the defendant's or the arrestee's constitutional rights, but it usually does not lead to the imposition of civil penalties onto the police officer. So I think she's concerned with holding police officers accountable for knowing what the law actually is. Interestingly enough, by the time the officers got to the station to book the partygoers, they did not actually book them under the charge of unlawful entry. They booked them under disorderly conduct. So the officers here were kind of going back and forth as to what laws the partygoers had violated, and I think that bothered some of the justices.
Thank you. Let's move to our first audience question.
Hey, so I have a question about qualified immunity, specifically the fact that Justice Thomas wrote this decision. I found that interesting because it wasn't even, I think it was in June where they released the Zeigler decision, and he had his own opinion there saying that when the appropriate case comes, he wants to discuss the potential merits of the current application of qualified immunity and the existence of that doctrine. And so I wondered if you read anything into the fact that he was the author of this opinion, specifically about qualified immunity, without any comment about potential applications in the future. If the appropriate case comes to review qualified immunity, the fact that he didn't talk at all about potential problems with qualified immunity.
That's a great question. I think Justice Thomas's opinion in June that you referenced raised a lot of eyebrows about revisiting qualified immunity, and it's not a question that the court has sort of readdressed in a long time. In this case, actually, the ACLU filed a very good brief in support of the partygoers in this case, sort of outlining why qualified immunity doctrine may be may have been wrong from the beginning, and that brief tracks Professor Will Bode's sort of now seminal article on this topic, but nobody really asked the court to revisit qualified immunity in the first instance. And Justice Thomas, while writing separately, often writing separately to identify potentially wrong decisions, decisions that he may be, precedent that he thinks may be incorrect, will follow that precedent unless, in cases, where he's basically said, I'd accept a case, I'd be interested in a case that raises this squarely. We'll still apply sort of that pre-existing doctrine. And as far as why he was assigned the opinion, I that would just be, I mean, even more speculation on my behalf. I mean, the chief has to assign or the court has to assign one opinion basically to each justice. So maybe this is just the one that fell in Justice Thomas's lap.
Fair enough.
Thank you for your question. Seeing as there are no more questions in the queue, Brian, do you have any closing remarks before we end today?
No, I don't. Again, I'll just reiterate that I don't think this case is going to show up in a lot of briefs of police officers and government officials who have been sued. And just as a reminder that the qualified immunity standard is still there and of course, should be following it. But other than that, there's really not much new law here other than I think what probably will be the most interesting facts of the term. I'd be surprised if we got a more interesting set of facts than this.
Great. Well, it looks like actually one person has put in a question, so
Great.
Let's turn to them real fast.
Hey, sorry, it's actually me again. I had a second question. I wasn't sure if
sure.
I was going to ask one. Okay, so back to, let's say, hypothetically, they open up the idea of looking at the officer's state of mind and the officer deciding what to charge and whether the officer knew a specific thing could be charged or had a mistake of law in their minds. I guess two parts. Part one, do you think that could actually lead to almost a reversal of what Ginsburg might be looking for, where, okay, if the officer subjectively thought they had a probable cause, that would end up starting to defeat qualified immunity, even if it was like a clear fault, like, you know, clear error in law, if the officer subjectively thought that they could? And then part B, let's say that it does get put in and put into sort of to an officer's detriment. So now if officers subjectively have the wrong law in mind when they go to arrest people, it could lead to qualified immunity problems. Do you think there would be closer working together between prosecutors' offices and officers to make sure they have the right law when they're arresting people?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't given much thought to it, and you make a good point. You know, if an officer thinks they have probable cause and the subjective intent of the officer matters, then I can see a defense that, well, I thought I had probable cause for X, Y, and Z reasons, and I subjectively believed it, so it doesn't matter that I objectively there was no probable cause. I think ultimately it would lead to a lot of police officers having to testify, I guess, to their state of mind. And I'm not sure how much it would do. I police officers get trained based on Supreme Court precedent all the time, so perhaps they would review the laws more closely than they have. But I suspect that wouldn't change too much when it comes to 1983 litigation. Now, when it comes to whether or not they had probable cause to enter a home and they find something in the home, I think you'd have a lot more litigation in the criminal aspect of probing exactly what the officer was thinking when he saw this and when he saw that. Why didn't you think there was an innocent explanation for this, or why didn't you think there was an innocent explanation for that? And it would muddy up a good bit the actual sort of criminal process. But that's just my off-the-cuff thoughts there.
Fair enough. And do you think it's possible that it could end up leading to a lot more? Because I know discovery is a big problem for officers as they try to go about their business when there's qualified immunity litigation. That's the number one complaint I hear from officers, is that when there's a discovery process, qualified immunity really hampers and it worries them. Do you think we'd see a lot more of that if we ended up opening up this sort of subjective state of mind?
I think so, yeah. I think no question. Cases that would be dead bang losers, 1983 cases, based on the evidence that the police officer found, or based on sort of the objective factors, would still have to be litigated. Now that I think about it, I think it probably would proliferate 1983 litigation because, the officer would say, I was thinking X, Y, and Z, but you can always disbelieve testimony, subjective testimony. So a lot of more cases would end up going to trial because it'd be a fact issue as to what the officer was actually thinking. So it could complicate the litigation quite significantly. I suspect, I mean, Justice Ginsburg's concurrence is very short. No one else joined it. I suspect that the court's not interested in revisiting that question. I would be surprised if it did. I'm sure there will be many law reviews that latch onto it in the future, as I believe Orrin Kerr was tweeting about yesterday, that there'll probably be 10 law review articles addressing this two-paragraph, three-paragraph concurrence.
All with the great titles, I'm sure.
Yeah, right. And there may be a petition or two out there asking the court to revisit it, just as I'm sure there will be several petitions asking the court to revisit qualified immunity based on Justice Thomas's concurrence last term. But I would be surprised if qualified immunity is changing at all going forward.
And I guess my last question, if there's still time, is your personal opinion. Do you have a particular stance on qualified immunity as it stands? Should it exist the way it does for officers? Should subjective standards be used? Would you change qualified immunity in any way if you were Supreme Court justice for a day?
Oh, wow. I haven't actually thought about it. I've gone through Will Bode's article. I think it's persuasive as an original matter, but I guess I don't really have a personal opinion on it, to be perfectly honest.
And what's Will Bode's article?
He wrote an article. If you pull the ACLU amicus brief from the docket, you can find it on SCOTUS blog. It's in there. He just argues that as an original matter, originalism principles, that qualified immunity our qualified immunity precedents are incorrect.
Fair enough. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, caller, for your questions. It looks like we do have one more question in the queue. Let's move to the next caller.
Yes, it's David Emerson, the Berkeley chapter of the Federalist Society. A question that you may be able to address, having looked at the decision in this case, is whether or not any of the justices expressed concern about the application in this case of what appeared to be collective guilt rather than individualized guilt, especially as when you refer to some of the statements made by Justice Thomas, which appear to be a very broad brush applying to everyone there, and it's unclear, especially given that criminal justice should be meted out on an individual basis, whether or not there was any concern by the justices that was not being applied.
That's a great question, because it did come out in the briefs, and each party, you know, there were 16 partygoers here that were involved in litigation, and each one had a different experience, or not each one had a different experience, but some were, you know, some people were told by a friend that it was a party, so they had no idea. At least they argued that it was the party was not sanctioned. You know, some had the two women who were entertainers there had spoken specifically to Peaches, who had given them permission to be there, so they seemed to have a stronger argument. I think the court stayed away from those issues. Because of sort of everybody was observing the same general conduct, and the house was in the same sort of disarray for everybody, that there was enough there for probable cause. Now, I would bet that if the case went to trial as to each of the individual partygoers, there would be many who would there would not be beyond reasonable doubt that they knew or should have known. You know, someone may have been there for 5 minutes, for example, and that person would say, "I just walked in. I just got here. I was invited by my friend John, and you know, I had no idea what was going on." That person wouldn't be convicted. There was not enough evidence to establish that he knew or should have known that it was vacant. But there was enough based on the state of play when the officers got there for probable cause, which again, the court stressed is a pretty low standard and shouldn't be conflated with the standard of guilt. But yeah, I think that there was, at least in my discussions with people who watched the case closely, that those were real concerns in the briefing. But given that the case kind of proceeded in block with the 16 plaintiffs on the question of probable cause, that's how it kind of went up. The D.C. Circuit didn't spend much time parsing each individual, and at argument, it didn't seem that the justices were interested in doing that as well. But I take your point. I think it is a legitimate concern.
Okay, and if I can ask just one follow-up question. Was there any concern, again, expressed by any of the justices about the parties themselves were ultimately charged with, you know, a different offense than what was presented as the probable cause justification at the premises? So was there any concern that this was actually an indication that there wasn't necessary probable cause, and that the police were just using a catch-all category to cover the fact that there was a problem with the original arrest?
Yes. The justice did not raise any concerns about that in the opinion. Again, the opinion is just Justice Thomas, joined by six other justices, and then Justice Sotomayor's concurrence and Justice Ginsburg's concurrence. But I think that is going a little bit to what Justice Ginsburg's concerns were in her concurrence about the officer's subjective intent. Since courts can't look at the subjective intent of the officers, it doesn't matter if what they end up charging the individuals with was the same thing as whether there was probable cause to arrest them in the first place. There can be probable cause to arrest you, for example, for a blown taillight. And they arrest you, they take you down, and they find, you know, an illicit substance on you. That they don't charge you with a broken taillight, they charge you with possession of the illicit substance. That happens all the time. So there was some of that in the briefing, at least in the sort of background sections, sort of raising the specter that the officers had you know, not been above board in this case. But I think an oral argument that came up a little bit, but it did not make its way into the opinions, other than Justice Ginsburg's concurrence.
Okay. And typically I would expect that if an initial arrest resulted in more serious charge, that would be typically the way the charging would proceed. In this case, the charging proceeded to a lesser charge from Pierce. I think you mentioned what it was, the disturbing the peace. Is that what you mentioned?
It was something akin to drunk in public, but it wasn't that. Sorry, it's just escaped my mind.
All right. But it wasn't the initial.
No, it was not. And in fact, I think it was a lesser offense.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, caller, for your question. It looks like our queue is finished for questions. So, Brian, if you are, would you like anything to say before we finish today?
No, that's it. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Wonderful. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank you for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.